Blaise Pascal. 17th century, French mathematician and philosopher. Born in 1623. Grew up in the France of Cardinal Richelieu, who epitomized the merger of ecclesiastical and civil power. He died in 1662 at mere 39 years of age. 39. Martin Luther King Jr., 39. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, 39. Everything after 39, young people, is bonus. So, it's bonus. Yeah. But during his few years, he was recognized as a leading mathematician of his day and a brilliant philosopher. He never attended school or university, but was taught by his father, Etienne Pascal. While very young, his father moved to Paris. He was a civil servant, and they were immersed in the life of conventional 17th century Roman Catholicism. But in his late teens, at age 17, he moved again to Rouen, and while he was there, he came under the influence of a priest, Jean Guilbert, who preached the gospel in a way that challenged the Roman Catholic institutions of the day. He was a priest of the Jansenist tradition, a school of thought that was quite anti-scholastic, seeking to reform the church along the lines of the teachings of St. Augustine, along two lines in particular. One, that true faith was interior, a call to prayer, and second, that true faith included moral reform. Most of all, central to Jansenism was what was so ably captured by Augustine, the idea that a restless heart only finds rest when it finds rest in God. These seeds were planted in young Pascal. Though this movement stressed this heartfelt longing for God, it was also a movement that did not tolerate moral laxity in the spiritual life. And Pascal was introduced to the life of devotio, of devotion. This did not mean that he denied his Catholic heritage. To the contrary, he embraced it fully while appreciating the depth of his sin and his need for God's grace, and most of all, his need to devote himself to God. The primary testimony to this conversion is not from Pascal himself, but rather from his sister, Gilbert Pascal, who wrote, "The providence of God, having provided an occasion for my brother to read certain books of piety, God so enlightened him through this kind of study that he came to understand perfectly that the Christian religion obliges us to live only for God and to have no other objective in life but to serve him." What is noteworthy is that the overall religious context in which this is described, which perhaps comes out best, what is noteworthy is the overall context in which this is experienced, and it comes out best in a description of his father. Years later, Gilbert's daughter described her grandfather, Pascal's father, in this way: "A pious enough man, but he had not yet received the gift of illumination." And then this remarkable description. Describing her grandfather, she said, "He thought he could combine the values of secular success with the practice of the gospel." Not so her uncle, Blaise Pascal. However, while this was a defining and definite turning point, Pascal had no joy and no peace. He was in time heavily involved in the debates between the Jansenists and the Jesuits. It was Pascal who coined the term Jesuitical. And further, he was a good man, moral, not subject to what his sister called the ordinary vices. Yet despite his commitment to this kind of theological debate, despite his commitment to moral reform and renewal, he was not a happy man. He was lonely, depressed, and in financial straits. While intellectually accepting the gospel, he was listless and powerless against what he called vanity and emptiness. He came to a deep yearning for something that was deeper, more pervasive. In 1651, his father died, and a year later, against his objections, his sister Jacqueline became a nun. But one of the things that happened as a result of that was he began to visit regularly her convent, and he found there a place of spiritual retreat and renewal. And after many visits, in November of 1654, Monday evening, November 23, we have an event for which Pascal is so well known, the event often called the Night of Fire. He solved the dilemma, the problem that had been hounding him since the death of his father. Only after his death, 9 years later, did the full extent of this experience on this night come to light. A servant noticed what appeared to be some extra padding in his vest. And what they found there was a piece of paper or parchment on which Pascal had described what he had experienced on that night, a fire. It was a powerful event, but one that he chose to remain silent about, to keep the particulars of the experience between himself and God. He spoke about how at 10:30 in the evening, and how for the next 2 hours, he experienced burning fire with the one he knows to be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, the God who granted him in that hour a deep serenity, a joy, a peace. He speaks again and again and again about tears of joy. He speaks about renunciation, total and sweet. It was a mystical experience of encounter with Jesus in which he found joy and peace. He found God and God alone. It was an affective knowledge of Jesus, an encounter of persons, not merely an encounter with an idea, not merely an encounter with truth, but with God's very self. And it was to prove to be the most defining moment of his life. He did not bypass his rational capacities, yet what he experienced was joy unspeakable. He continued to live outwardly, much as he had before. But as his sister put it, he was now recognized, this is her description of him, to be a jolly penitent. A jolly penitent. I yearn for this. That's what I want to be. A jolly penitent. I have an article coming out this fall with that title. Further, starting in January of 1655, Pascal was meeting regularly with a spiritual director, one Father Lemaître de Sochi, a prudent and wise man. And it was perhaps at least in part because of him that Pascal did not turn away from philosophy and mathematics. He could so easily have abandoned philosophy. He was so disgusted, in a sense, with the approach to scholarship of his generation. But it was Father de Sochi who persuaded him to not leave his vocation as a philosopher and mathematician. What he learned was that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jesus Christ is not the God of philosophers, but the God who is known through prayer and through personal experience. And this, in turn, informed his apologetic for the Christian faith, particularly the tradition of Jansenism, within which he chose to stand. His conviction that the Gospels reveal both the glory as well as the wretchedness of the human person, an apologetic that would affirm both the analytical and mathematical, as well as the intuitive and affective. This was never published, this apologetic, due to his premature death, but prior to his death, he was taking a score of notes, and we do have these published in his pensée. Read them. They've never been so relevant. Simone Veil. A remarkable woman, an insightful thinker, whose intellectual capacities were matched by her extraordinary Christian devotion. Yet we cannot avoid that hers was a troubled, tortured life that eventually led to her early death. She was born in 1909, raised by an affluent, secular Jewish family in Paris, and even as a child was recognized to have unique intellectual capacities. Very early on, she pursued studies in philosophy and science, and by her late teens was teaching philosophy in the public school system of France. But what stands out even more, especially in her early years, was that though she was a philosopher and intellectual, she had a deep concern for the needy, especially the poor. This led her eventually to resign her position in teaching, associate with the rising leftist movement in France, to identify with the cause of the laborer. Without needing any income, she was independently wealthy. She chose to take a job in an auto factory so that she could experience for herself what it felt like to be a laborer. And then in 1936, she went off to Spain and served as a cook to the soldiers who were fighting on the left against Franco. With regard to her faith, she spoke of her early life as one characterized by Christian sensibilities. Or perhaps better, that even though she was raised in a secular Jewish home, she grew up with a Christian inspiration, as she put it. Her actual coming to faith was marked by three notable and pivotal experiences. In 1937, she was in Portugal, spending time with her parents. She was there to recover from burns she had received from boiling oil while in the kitchen staff in Spain. They stayed in a small fishing village, and in her autobiography, Waiting for God, she writes, "In this state of mind then, and in a wretched condition physically, I entered the little Portuguese village, which alas was very wretched too, on the very day of its patronal festival. I was alone. It was the evening, and there was a full moon. It was by the sea. The wives of the fishermen were going in procession to make a tour of all the ships, carrying candles and singing what must surely have been very ancient hymns of heart-rending sadness. Nothing can give an idea of it. I have never heard anything so poignant. There, the conviction was suddenly born in me that Christianity was preeminently the religion of slaves, that slaves cannot help belonging to it, and I among others. At the time, she spoke to no one about this experience. Then later that same year, she visited Switzerland and Italy. She suffered terribly from migraine headaches, and she went to Switzerland for treatment, and while there developed a friendship with Jean Pasternak, also there for medical treatment, and they entered into a regular correspondence, as he, playing a role very similar to one described this morning, entered into a conversation, just listened to her, responded to her inquiries, and this continued after she left and went to Italy. In Italy, she was particularly taken by the religious art of Milan and Florence, and then in Rome was overcome by the beauty of the Catholic liturgy, especially her experience of the Pentecost Mass at St. Peter's in Rome. She wrote to her friend, "Nothing is more beautiful than the texts of the Catholic liturgy." And then in Assisi, noting in her letters, "At Assisi I forgot all about Milan, Florence, Rome, and the rest." And then further, now in Waiting for God, we read, "There, alone in a 12th century Romanesque chapel of Santa Maria degli Angeli, an incomparable marvel of purity, where St. Francis often used to pray, something stronger than I was compelling me for the first time in my life to go down on my knees." Yet back in Paris, it didn't take, so to speak. She was increasingly disillusioned. She was disillusioned with her passion for leftist causes, shaken by the victory of Franco in Spain and the growing movement towards the right in northern France and, of course, in Germany. This disillusionment, though, drove her further on her spiritual pilgrimage. She speaks of a persistent reading of the Bible, especially the Gospels. She was also reading Pascal, and in the following year, in 1938, she spent 10 days, including Holy Week, in Solesmes, a Benedictine abbey in northeastern France. Still suffering from headaches, experiencing no relief, suffering incredibly, the pain, nevertheless, was one in which, in the midst of it, she was able to find deep consolation in the beauty of the liturgy, especially the chanting. And she speaks of this experience as one that enabled her to understand the possibility of divine love in the midst of affliction, her line. Most of all, she had what she spoke of as an encounter with Christ in his passion, in which she wrote, "Christ himself came down and took possession of me."